You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
If you are a fan of the NBA, then you remember the Big Three, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, and Ray Allen, who won the Boston Celtics a championship in 2008, the first year they played together. Journalist Michael Hawley, in his book, appropriately named The Big Three, tells the story of how this team was put together, from its purchase in 2003 by a new ownership group to its championship year. It chronicles the hiring of Danny Ainge as general manager and Ainge's hiring of Doc Rivers as head coach and how their philosophies blended to produce a championship team. Michael Hawley is the best-selling author of Belichick and Brady and the best-selling collaborator for David Ortiz's Poppy, My Story. He is currently a co-executive producer and co-host of Brother from Another on Peacock, a talk show and studio host at NBC Sports Boston, and professor at Boston University. Michael Hawley, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here and to be in conversation with you, my brother. So I don't know. I can just tell you're going to ask me some good stuff.
So well, I'll have to tell you that
I'm
you
on the
know.
Edge of my I'm on the edge of my seat.
Well, you probably know that Boston throughout the country isn't the most beloved sports town. But the Big Three story for me, I was going to say Rajon, he's not even part of the Big Three, but that whole team with Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, and I was a Miami Heat fan when they had their Big Three. And to me, it was incredible basketball. It was an incredible rivalry. But with your book, I was surprised to learn about the turnover of ownership because, you know, we weren't paying close attention in the early 2000s of all of the mechanizations, all the things going on with ownership. And so the Celtics was sold for $360 million to an ownership group that sort of started them toward the Big Three because that ownership group hired Danny Ainge. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, they at that time, that $360 million price, that was a record at the time. You know, a little closer to where you are in Dallas, you know, a year earlier had sold for $75 million fewer than that $360 million. But Dallas, you know, Mark Cuban had the arena. Like the Celtics don't own the arena that they play in. They're tenants. And the Boston Bruins own actually the Garden. And so when their owner paid $360 million for the Celtics, people were looking at him like, what are you doing, man? That's way too much money. He even said that, you know, he was he went to Stanford Business School. His father was a business professor. So everybody looking at it as a business deal thought, now this doesn't make a lot of sense, but his logic was, Wick Grosbeck is the owner's name. His logic was, hey, I look at the books. This team is making money, even though they're not winning that much. What I can do is borrow half of that price and I can continue to pay it back once I have the teams, kind of like paying a mortgage. And then after a while, I have a little confidence in myself. I think we'll make a lot more money than the Celtics are making right now. And it'll be a good purchase. He turned out to be right. But not only did he get in there, Hopeton, and buy the team, kind of changed the way they did business. They were kind of like, you can relate to this. It's like your favorite business. That's a mom and pop kind of operation. It's very intimate. So you like the intimacy, but the business is kind of far behind the modern ways of doing business. And that's what the Celtics were. I mean, they didn't have a lot of computers in the office, believe it or not. They weren't really thinking about business opportunities. They thought, hey, here's marketing for the Celtics back then. We're the Boston Celtics. Isn't that enough? and he said, no, that's not enough. You can't do marketing that way in the 21st century. So he really stepped it up outside of basketball, you know, marketing, sales and promotions. They really increased their spending there. And then when it got to basketball operations, one of his co-owners, a guy by the name of Steve Pagliuca, he was friends with Danny Ainge. He had been friends with Danny Ainge for years before he became a co-owner of the Celtics. He said, hey, Danny, do you want to lead the basketball operations here? Danny said, nope, don't want to do it. I'm loving my life as a retired player. I do a little TNT basketball every now and then. I'm good. And he came back to him a couple of years later, and Danny accepted the invitation. And that's really how the story began, because Danny is one of those guys who just doesn't come into a situation thinking, let me just get by to get by. He comes in asking the big question, are we championship ready? And if the answer is no, I'll do whatever it takes, even if it's unpopular, to get us to that point.
Well, Danny's not a stranger to being unpopular. Matter of fact, he was one of the players when he played for the Boston Celtics that was, for want of a better term, opponents may have considered the most irritating player on the Boston Celtics.
I grew up in Ohio, and I couldn't stand him. I could not stand Danny Ainge, and just he was an irritant. He was just, he was that dude. Like, man, look at this guy. He's not even the best player on the team. Just always out there trying to start something, trying to provoke people. But that's what he was. He would get under your skin. But if you look at that team that he was on, especially like the last Celtics championship team before the new big three in 2008, he's a really good player, man. He was the only player in the starting lineup who was not a Hall of Famer. But if you look at Danny Ainge, look at his career, he was just a solid NBA player who could have done more, but you know, you play with Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale and Larry Bird, DJ, Dennis Johnson. You can't get outside of your game because those guys have to get their points too.
Well, going back to Boston as a sports city, you know, in Black America, when we think of Boston, generally speaking, there's not a whole lot of love for Boston. Right. I especially think about the history of Bill Russell, really the way he was treated in Boston and his refusal for many, many years to come to Boston. On the other hand, they're an enigma because Red Auerbach was a mentor of John Thompson. Yep. I believe he brought on the first Black, you know, drafted the first Black basketball player. So, and Red Auerbach actually spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. So they're this kind of this team where some folks love to hate Boston teams. But on the other hand, Red Auerbach was ahead of his time.
Yeah, I mean, as well said, you know, Red Auerbach drafted the first Black player in the NBA, Chuck Cooper, in 1950. He also hired the first Black head coach in North American sports, who was Bill Russell.
Yeah.
And Red was a provocateur in some ways too. Like, he was one of those guys who would look at a situation very similar to Ainge and say, well, why is it this way? I don't want to accept that this is how we should do business. So, you know, NBA was an all white league, and he didn't have any conversation with anybody and say, hey, I want your permission to draft a Black player. He just did it. And the reason he was in position to draft Bill Russell himself is because he got a sense that some of the teams in the top spots, you know, would not accept a Black player. So he made a move to the top of the draft, you know, cashed in some favors just to get in position to draft Russell. Now, Russell, what a treasure he is. And I've had an opportunity to speak with him, spend a significant time with him over the years. And I asked him about exactly what you just said. What was it like playing for the Celtics? He said, man, I love playing for the Celtics. I love the Celtics. He said, like, playing for the Celtics with my brothers, that was heaven for me. Now, the city of Boston at that time, no, I did not enjoy the city, but I enjoyed the Celtics. And I think it's, you know, I hear a lot of people, you know, talking about Boston still to this day about the racial history. And I don't think any city, including Boston, can run away from its racial past. You can't put a spin on it. You can't soften it. It's there. And I'm glad that Bill Russell was one of the athletes at the time who called it out. I mean, we're talking about athletes today who are using their platform and are speaking about injustice and encouraging people to vote and being politically engaged. Man, Bill Russell was doing that before it was popular. So he did it in Boston. He did it around the country. Even after he retired, he continued to do it. And so he's had a complicated relationship with Boston. I think it began to that frost started to come off, I'd say in the probably as late as the 80s. I remember he did a tribute in Boston in the 1990s. It was a Bill Russell tribute and had a lot of people there. You know, Aretha Franklin was there, you know, Wilt Chamberlain. That was Wilt Chamberlain was still alive. He was there. Brian Gumbel was the MC. You had a lot of folks. And I think it moved Russell. It moved him because I think he had a lot of memories. And he had a lot of anger toward the city, and to see the city turn around and bring him in and give him this this big embrace in a public way at the Garden meant a lot to him. So, yeah, man, I think it's a great question that you bring up about Boston. And I think a lot of American cities, and this is where it gets a little uncomfortable for other cities. Because I will tell you straight up about all the things I know about Boston and the racial history. For example, I mean, there was a famous case. I don't know if you heard about the Charles Stewart case here in the late 1980s, where it was pretty much a preview of what Amy Cooper did in Central Park, but worse, a lot worse. You know, Amy Cooper, the who had her dog right in Central Park. Hey, a black man is attacking me. A black man is, ooh, and she's calling 911. And she knows what that means. She knows what kind of dog whistle that is, right? Well, Charles Stewart took it to another level, you know, 30 years earlier, where he's around Northeastern University in Boston, and he is with his wife. She was in a pregnancy class, and she was shot and killed. And he called 911 and said, hey, this black man, this black jogger attacked us and killed my wife. And the city bought it, brother. The city bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. And I remember the Boston Globe, where I used to work, and I did the research on this. It was shameful. Boston Globe has this headline, Camelot couple, you know, has their lives destroyed by this black criminal. And there were columnists at the Globe talking about these thugs and these animals, seriously. And you know what? It was a lie. He did it. He did it. But that just tells you, not just in Boston, but in America, you know, what the fragility of some people, of some white people, when it comes to black people, their insecurity when it comes to black people. And it tells you about the fragility of black life, where a lie like that can put a lot of people at risk. And that's what it was. That's what it was like in Boston at that time. You know, black men were walking around. Every black man was a suspect. You know, houses were raided. People were just grabbed on the street and patted down. And when I say this, I talk about this history because I'm challenging other communities to do the same things about their history. Racism did not begin in Boston. Racism is not over. And there are other cities who are looking at Boston saying, look over there. And I'm saying, yeah, look at Boston, no question. But look at yourselves, too.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopton Hay. My guest is Michael Hawley. He is the author of The Big Three, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and The Rebirth of the Celtics. Their last title was in 1986. And Paul Pierce was the building block of the Big Three. And there was a time when Rick Pitino was coach, and I recall paying attention that, was it going to be Antoine Walker, who played for Rick Pitino at the University of Kentucky, or was it going to be Paul Pierce? And it was pretty clear when Danny Ainge came in, he saw the value of Paul Pierce, and he traded Antoine Walker, actually brought him back, but traded him again. So Paul Pierce was the building block. And I will tell you that I did not know about the 50-point, 8-assist, 7-rebound game that Ray Allen had against LeBron James, where he actually had, I believe, 44 points, 12 rebounds, 11 assists. And this rivalry between the two, and I can recall the game in the playoffs. when Cleveland played Paul, where they both scored. I mean, I saw that game. That was, to me, that rivalry, the LeBron James, Paul Pierce rivalry, just stands out so much for me.
Yeah, that game you mentioned in 2006 really represented just like where the players were in their careers. You know, two terrific players, obviously LeBron at that point, 06, a young guy, he's 22 years old in 2006. And people are saying, is this the best player in the league at 22? It was a LeBron or Kobe conversation at that point. That's how talented he was. So he was a great player, and Pierce could see it. And Pierce could see the talent, but he kind of resented the position that LeBron was in, because LeBron not only was a player on the rise, his franchise was on the rise, and Pierce's franchise was on the decline. And he was playing at a high level, and it's almost like what Bradley Beal's doing right now with the Washington Wizards. You know, you're balling out, and you can't even get a sniff on an all-NBA team. You know, people don't really look at you as one of those great players, even though you are, because the team kind of shrouds the talent that you have. And so I think that was at the base of the rivalry. That was underneath everything that they did. And they went at it. And I hoped it. It wasn't – I'd love to tell you that, it was just they just did that on the court and off the court. They were the best of friends.
No, they were not.
They would give each other a nod or a fist bump. Hey, what's up? But, you know, Pierce was trying to go at LeBron, and LeBron sensed that, this dude's got a little extra. So he would go at him too. And I think that kind of set up the Eastern Conference semifinal in 08 that you referred to, where Pierce and LeBron down the stretch. Here's Pierce with a three, LeBron with a three. Here's Pierce with a drive to the basket. Here comes LeBron with a dunk in traffic. You know, they're going back and forth. And it came down to, like, truly the final minute of the game before the Celtics secured it. But I'm going to fast forward a little bit and tell you just how deep this rivalry was and continues to be today. Because if you listen to Pierce on
ESPN. From the booth. Still from the booth. He keeps taking shots at LeBron booth.
He's still taking shots at him. It's hilarious.
Wow, man.
But in 2010 with the decision, the Celtics, first of all, the Celtics were the last team to beat LeBron's Cavaliers. Volume 1 Cavaliers. Celtics beat them in the Eastern Conference semifinals again.
Wait, let me stop you there, because that was a series where, in my opinion, LeBron's lack of energy against the Celtics was so noticeable that you just saw no energy and I believe in the last game.
Well, yeah, and it's so interesting about to tell you about LeBron's talent that – you know, that is a lot of people say that, but if you look at that stat line,
I saw that stat line, but the
for
stat
his final
line,
game, he had a triple double, and they almost had a quadruple double.
But the wrong still, way. I saw the game.
But I'm saying 18 rebounds, Hopton, 18 rebounds in this last game is 26, 27 points. But you're right. It wasn't LeBron. As great as those stats were, it wasn't LeBron. It wasn't his normal thing. But when he walked off the court in Boston, and you've seen the video many times, he's removing his jersey before he gets to the locker room. The Celtics were in the opposite locker room, nodding their heads saying, oh, yeah. Yeah, we got him. He's going somewhere else. They felt like, whether it was true or not, they felt like they forced him to leave his hometown. Now, that may be revisionist history, but that's the way they looked at it at the time. And so when he went to, people forget, when he went to Miami for the 2010-2011 season, their first game was against Boston. They lost it. They played Boston a second time. They lost that game. They played Boston a third time. They lost that game. So Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen are thinking, so what? The big three in Miami? We ain't worried about them. But what happened shortly after that, they traded Kendrick Perkins. The whole dynamic of their team changed. And Miami became that team that the Celtics would never admit it because they couldn't stand them. But the Miami was a better team in year one and throughout that rivalry, that Celtics-Miami rivalry Miami was a better team.
So let's talk about the demise of the chemistry of the Boston Celtics. So I'm just sort of jumping there because the fallout between Rajon Rondo and Ray Allen sort of killed the Celtics. Like Rajon was close to Kevin. He was close to Paul Pierce. And the nastiness between them, as I read through your book, was, you know, much deeper than from me just reading the normal articles and watching the normal sports show. What was the seed of that nasty conflict between Rajon and Ray?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the best way to say it is people are complicated. People are complicated and people are multidimensional. And I say it that way because if you go to the very beginning of the Ray Rondo relationship, it was a mentor-mentee relationship, believe it or not. You know, Rondo spent a lot of time at Ray's house and talking about the business of the NBA, and he asked him a bunch of questions about, you know, his career and just all the things that he had accomplished. And so they were very friendly in year one. And I think a couple of things changed. You know, there was one, you know, exchange where Ray thought he was going to be traded, and he took that to Rondo, and he said, you know, Rondo, hey, they think about trading you too. They're talking about your attitude and all this stuff. And Rondo just took it the wrong way. Like, hey, man, why are you coming to me with this? Are you saying that it's my fault if I get traded? Are you saying I got an attitude problem? So it didn't land the way Ray wanted it to. But I think even the bigger picture is how they started to change as players. You know, you can have take it outside of basketball. You can have a mentor relationship with somebody, but maybe that relationship is not meant to stay that way. What happens when the mentee grows up? What happens when the mentee starts to get some footing and maybe is eye to eye with the mentor or maybe even above? And I think that's what happened with Rondo. He was a young player, so his game was going through the roof. And then Ray was starting to come down a little bit. He was the oldest of the big three. His game starting to soften a little bit. He'd already given up the most. He's already sacrificed the most because KG's game didn't change. Paul Pierce's game, his game didn't change. Ray Allen's game had to change for them to be successful. And any kind of big three, that third guy is going to give up a lot. So Ray gave up a lot. Then he was older and Rondo had control of the team. He's got the ball. So that was an uncomfortable dynamic among the Celtics. And then they just didn't, personality-wise, man, just think about them. Think about Rondo and think about Ray Allen. Ray Allen is like, Ray
OCD.
Allen, he could be part of Joe Biden's cabinet. You know what I mean?
Right.
he's a diplomat, man. He's like, he's a politician. And he's trying to look at both sides of an issue and try to bring people together. Rondo, man, if Rondo's not feeling you, Rondo will just tell you straight to your face, man. You know, hey, get out of my face. And Ray's not like that. So they just didn't connect. And then at the end, it was bad. It was really bad. And so the irony, Hopton, is that they gave this brother, Ray Allen, they gave him such a hard time for leaving for Miami when the truth is, and they all knew this, the truth is that was not sustainable. Ray and Rondo on the same team, one of them had to go. It wasn't going to be Rondo. So when Ray went to Miami, he actually did them a favor. Because if he had come back, that would have been so toxic, so combustible, that they probably would have been fighting every other week of practice.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Michael Holly. We're talking about his new book, The Big Three, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and the Rebirth of the Celtics. And we got to talk about Doc Rivers. And that's an interesting discussion because I read this great article in The Undefeated about the celebration of Black failure and sort of this the way, like, I think about the retreads in the coaching market. I mean, the Van Gundys hired over and over and over and over again, yet the focus, they don't have any problem yet. You know, the way that Doc Rivers was looked at, his inability to get to the finals with the Los Angeles Clippers, sort of this lack of in my mind, sufficient amount of respect for what he was able to accomplish with the Boston Celtics, with those having to manage the big three there. And the fact that Danny Ainge brought him on after what happened at Orlando, where, you know, from the outside looking in, he was fired too quickly at Orlando, at the Orlando Magic. There were some injury issues. And to some degree, I think Doc Rivers has not gotten the credit he deserves for what he did with the big three. And I think he's being over-criticized for his challenges with the Los Angeles Clippers.
Yeah, it's interesting. Your first point about just black coaches in general, that was one of the things that gave Doc Rivers pause before he took the Boston job. No, he had been fired. As you said, he'd been fired in Orlando. They got off to a 1-10 start. And, you know, he had been coach of the year just a couple of years before that. Got a team with, think about this. Think of how crazy this is. He got a team with four undrafted players in its starting five. Let me say it again. 80% of your starting five was not drafted in the NBA, where it's all about the talent. I mean, if you don't have top end talent, you won't win. I don't care what kind of coach you are. You got a bunch of undrafted guys on your roster. Nah, you're probably not going to be too successful, but he was able to get that team into the playoffs, which is just amazing. So he had been fired in Orlando, and he really paused about that next opportunity because, as friends of his told him, man, if you get fired there as black coach, that might be it for you. And you get for you a twice fired black coach, just as you said, Hopton, they're not going to be perceived the same way that a white coach, where you're not going to get that benefit of the doubt. So he really thought about it. But when he was in conversation with Danny Ainge, Danny Ainge was against this system that you just described. Ainge was saying, well, wait a minute. Why are all these coaches being fired? Any coach. Why are these coaches being fired when they're good basketball men? You got to look at the totality of the situation. So Danny told him flat out, you're going to come in here. This is a rebuild. I'm not judging you on 1 year. I'm not going to judge you on 3 years. I want to be in partnership with you. I want to build something here. And he put up, Danny Ainge put up, because Doc had an 18-game losing streak the year before they got the big three. People were calling for his firing in Boston. Lots of negativity swirling around the city, and Danny stuck with him, and Danny went to ownership and said, hey, just in case you're thinking that this is a coaching thing, this is not coaching. He's doing a great job. I have not given him the talent that he needs to win a championship. And then the next year they won it. So yeah, Doc plays a key role in this, not just with his perspective, but his understanding as a former pro player, Hopton. Hey, I know what it's like not to win a championship. You know, from the time, you know, growing up, he grew up in Chicago, and from the time he was like 7 or 8 years old to the time they won a championship, he would get down on his knees every night and pray for three things. He'd pray, okay, when he was a kid, he'd pray, hey, God, please help me get to the NBA. Got to the NBA in 1983. He said, God, please help me be an all-star player. Became an all-star in 1988. God, please help me be an NBA champion. It did not happen in his career. And it felt like it was a hole. Because think about how we as basketball fans talk about great players. You know, I was watching, Shaq and Charles Barkley and Kenny Smith the other night, and they were talking about championships. So Kenny Smith is saying, yeah, man, I had my two. I wish I had a third. Shaq saying, man, you know, he got his four. You know, I wish I had gotten more, and Barkley didn't have any. And look, Charles Barkley, great player, but there's something, and maybe it's unfair on our part as NBA fans, when we look at those guys who didn't win a championship, and we get into the greatest player conversations. If I come to you and say the greatest player in the NBA is Karl Malone, for example, you're gonna eat me up in a second. You're like, man, what did he win? You win any championships? And I lose the argument. So Doc Rivers knew that's how players think and that's how fans think. And he was able to tap into that desperation that Pierce had, that Allen had, and KG had, and said, look, if you want to win, this is what you're going to have to do. You don't want to be one of those guys they talk about as never having won a championship. And it clicked. And he was the right guy for that time. You know, as get a little biblical, as the book of Esther says, he was the right time for a time such as this. So he was the right time for it. He was the right man for it at the right time.
What was interesting is that Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce were on losing teams. And they were getting tired of Ray Allen's with Seattle Supersonics, Kevin Garnett with the Minnesota Timberwolves. And I can recall paying attention to them making it to the ends, to the finals, the conference finals once, and thinking, okay, and then they receded. And so what's interesting is that Danny Ainge brings these players together with Paul Pierce from teams that are losing, but by bringing them together with Paul Pierce, it really gets them over the hump. And what's also interesting is the difference in personalities. I kind of threw in there earlier that Ray Allen was OCD. I mean, yeah, doing the same thing the same way over and over and over again. And then you had Kevin Garnett, who loved to scream, holler, curse. I mean, we have these really sort of, you know, you think of Ray Allen as the gentleman.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you, there was a famous scene on TNT where Kevin Garnett called Ernie dog. And Ernie thought Kevin Garnett was insulting him. So they had to have a segment where Kevin Garnett had to explain to him, no, dog is a term of endearment. You my dog.
Yeah, it was, but you know, I'm glad you bring that up. Because I think in basketball and in business, I think we just got to be mindful that, you know, certain personality types can work as long as they are surrounded by, you know, contrasting personalities that they kind of complement one another. But, you know, I can say in your business, you can have different types of personalities and have that business to be successful as long as you don't have too much of the same thing. If you got four Kevin Garnetts on one team, that's not going to work. That's just a little too much energy. That's a little too much over the top. And if you got four Rays on one team, then you need somebody. That's not going to work either. So I think it was just a good balance of personalities where you had Kevin, who was just so intense and who would cuss and would scream and do all kinds of outrageous things to lead the team. And then Ray was steady. Rondo was unpredictable and moody. Paul Pierce had a little moodiness to him too, but he was a scorer. Anytime you need a bucket, anybody's having an off night, hey, go to Paul. Paul's not only going to hit a jumper for you. Paul's going to go to the basket and get fouled and give you some free throws. And then you put all sorts of personalities around those guys, and that's how you have a successful team. And I think it takes a good manager like Doc to recognize what everybody's strength is, personality-wise, and play to it and see how it all comes together. And it just always fascinates me, really, if you think about all the books I've written, no matter what the subject is, whether it's baseball or basketball or football, ultimately, the books I write are about team building. I'm just fascinated with team building. It really.
Well, I will tell you, I will not read any books on the New England Patriots. So.
I understand it because there's a lot going on with those personalities, too. But
you know, that
I think that's what it comes down to. I think it comes down to team building in anything, basketball or otherwise.
But at some point, the star gets tired of the coach. So we have, you know, Belichick and Brady as an example. Brady was like, all right, I'm done. I'm ready to move on. And frankly, Belichick had actually sounded like he had actually been ready to move on a year or two before that. But the owner wouldn't let him move on.
That's right.
So Rajon and Doc and Red Auerbach famously told the Celtics that the team is too nice. He told Doc, the team is too nice. You need an instigator.
Too nice, Doc. You need some agitators.
But Rajon was already famous for being an intra-instigator, intra-team instigator.
Word. Yeah, that was his thing. And Danny loved Rajon. I think he still does to this day. He saw him when he was very young. Saw him in high school. And when he saw him in college, he just looked at this unusual player, you know, 6'1", but long arms, and he played much bigger than that. You know, not a great shooter, but still able to impact the game in other ways. And Danny just loved him. He kept talking about Rondo during the draft process. And it seems like, oh, yeah, of course, you go get Rondo now. But think about where they were when Rondo was drafted. When Rondo was drafted earlier that day, they had traded for a point guard, Sebastian Telfair. They had given up a lottery pick, and they brought in Sebastian Telfair, and also to get rid of Ray LaFrance's contract. So if you're the owner of the team, you're saying, no, wait a minute. Now, Danny, you're telling me we just acquired a young point guard. We gave up a lottery pick for a young point guard, and now we're going back into the draft to get another point guard about the same age as the guy we just acquired. Danny did it. But the owner said, man, you love this guy so much. I don't know how you're going to make it work. Well, why don't you go back into the draft and get him? And that's what Danny did. But Danny and Rondo used to talk on the court. They talk off the court. A really close relationship. And I think Danny felt like he had a kindred spirit in Rondo, because Danny's a little unusual and offbeat. And so is Rondo. I mean, Rondo's like, he's like that artist, man. He's like that abstract artist. You just never know what you're going to get from him. And Danny has some of that in his personality. But Doc and Rondo, off and on relationship, because Rondo used to drive Doc crazy. And if Rondo didn't want to listen to you, he would just tune you out. He'd tune out the coaching staff. And if he felt like they didn't know what they were talking about, he stopped listening to them. And some of his teammates, beyond Ray Allen, some of his teammates looked at him like, hey, what are you on right now? But when he was at his best, when he was really playing at his highest level, that whole operation, everybody, including Ray, played their best basketball, because Rondo had this vision and he just had a feel for the offense, and he knew how to set everybody up to be them best, to be their best selves.
And what I loved about Rondo, along with Mario Chalmers, fearlessness, not afraid of the moment, not cowed by superstars. Both of them, Mario Chalmers, of course, with the Miami Heat, the point guard there with LeBron and those guys. But of course, Mario Chalmers hit the game tying shot against Memphis State in the NCAA finals, and they went over to overtime and actually ended up defeating that Derrick Rose team with Memphis State. But both of those players were players that people were like, but they were not afraid of the moment. They were fearless, and they were not cowed by superstars. And Rondo was not cowed by the Miami Heat and their big three.
Yeah, you need that. You need it. And think about it, Hope. Don't we all need that? We all need it. Where you don't want to be starstruck, especially if you have a valid point. You have a valid point to make. Think about this. How many people are able to tell stars, no, that's not right? Or, oh, wait a minute. Well, how about we do it this way? You know, because stars are so used to telling other people, hey, this is the way it's going to be. And everybody just kind of scurries around and just conforms. So the star is happy. To stand up to the star, it does take some guts, as you mentioned, but I think it's necessary for a better product. Because these guys, most stars in any industry, are so used to yes people.
Yes.
You know, people telling them what they think they want to hear, instead of telling them the truth, instead of challenging them. So I think you need that for a team as well. And Rondo provided that for sure.
And Rondo was brilliant. I think that's the thing, that he was incredibly intelligent and brilliant. And I've had those situations where I've been in a college classroom and we have a student that is actually smarter than the teacher.
Yeah,
he's correcting the teacher. Bruh. He was one of those kind of guys, right?
Hey, Hope, I teach some classes. I tell my students all the time, to look, you guys are all smarter than I am. So you can help me become smarter. I can help you because I have the advantage of experience. So take advantage of my experience. I'll take advantage of your intelligence, and we'll have a good time here in the classroom, because there are a lot of really smart people who need guidance. They just need guidance. You got to understand what they are, what they're doing. And I think this is especially true in our communities and Black communities, where a lot of times people will try to fit a personality or intelligence into a certain category. Like, hey, this is a smart kid. This smart kid, he or she may not learn the way you think they should learn, but they're bringing a lot to the classroom, and we got to meet them where they are and take advantage of the strengths that they have without having some preconceived notion of like how this intelligence is supposed to present itself.
So when I look at the legacy of the Big Three, in my mind, they sort of ushered in another era of quote unquote, the Big Three. Before the Big Three at Miami, it was really Boston Celtics through trades that ushered in that whole thing that we need to have three superstars, of which in both cases, one is going to have to push their game to the side to fit in. And so what do you see as the legacy of the Boston Celtics Big Three?
They're a group that came together quickly, and this is hard to do because even LeBron and the Heat didn't do this. They're a team that came in and gelled immediately and won a championship. That is so difficult. It wasn't just those three guys who won a championship in their first year together. It was all new bench players too. Like they had guys like James Posey and Eddie House and Big Baby Davis, all these guys who had never played together before. Later in the season, PJ Brown, your homeboy from New Orleans, also had Sam Cassell, some veterans who came in and made big plays on demand in that first season. So that, I think that's one. But I think the other thing is they were the last super team in the NBA to come together by conventional means. Here's a general manager who sits here. He's got a star. He's trying to find pieces for that star without necessarily that star's permission to get other players. Like Ray Allen didn't want to be traded to Boston. He didn't want to be traded, but it was out of his control. So he was traded on draft night to Boston. Kevin Garnett initially didn't want to go to Boston, but once he saw Ray and Paul there, he said, okay, I can work with them. And that's not how it works today. Like now a player like LeBron, when he left Miami for Cleveland, he said, okay, I'm going to leave Miami for Cleveland. And they got a number one overall pick and Andrew Wiggins. I'd like them to trade that pick for an established player. So that's how they get Kevin Love. And he's just kind of operating things behind the scenes as a player. And same thing, when he went to the Lakers, he made Anthony Davis get there. Hey, you tell the general manager, go get Anthony Davis. When Kevin Durant goes to Golden State, it's the players who drew him to Golden State. So now it's more player directed. And I think the Big Three, that team was the last team where it was general manager directed of bringing a team together.
Speaking of the current affair of basketball, the Golden State Warriors, that era is done, right? I mean, it's over. Done. It's over. It's over. They had a nice run, but it's done. And they're like the New England Patriots. They set a record. Patriots went 16-0. The Golden State Warriors set the record for most wins in a season, yet lost. Now, mind you, I think a lot of people don't realize how many NBA championships sort of turned on an injury.
Yeah.
That the Big Three didn't win multiple in the early stages because of injuries. That injuries. They just kind of, it was injuries that sort of killed it.
Yeah, and that's what happens, man. That's why I always say, in any sport, just enjoy it while you see it. You know, appreciate what's in front of you because there's just no guarantee it's going to keep going and going. And I got caught up in it too. I mean, the Warriors, when they had Kevin Durant, that's the best basketball team I've ever seen in my life. You know, you got Durant, you got Curry, you got Klay Thompson, Draymond doing his thing. You got Iguodala coming off the bench. He had a lot of really good things going on there with that team. And I got caught up and I said, man, who's going to beat this team? I can't see anybody beating them. They go, they beat Cleveland once and they go back, they beat Cleveland another time. Kevin Durant, finals MVP both times. I'm like, hey, nobody's going to beat this team. No, didn't have to be somebody who beats the team. It's an injury. And I think injuries, first an injury to Durant, then an injury to Klay Thompson and a re-injury from Klay Thompson. You know, Steph Curry broke his hand. I mean, that's what happens. It's all time sensitive. So you got a championship operation. You just savor it for as long as you can, because it's just no guarantee it's going to go on for 5 years, 10 years. And you mentioned the Patriots to be in contention, to make the playoffs, you know, 11 straight years and 17 out of 19 years, all this stuff. That's just unusual. And so when it comes to an end, you have to look back. I say to Patriots fans all the time in Boston, like, why are you mad? I'm not mad at anything. You know, it was an era of football, the likes of which we may never see again. And so when it comes to an end, you start doing that blame game. Well, it wouldn't have ended if this had happened. It was going to end after a generation of being competitive. That's not normal. So you just appreciate it and just think about what's going to happen next.
Do you think that it's been proven now by Tom Brady that Belichick really needed him, that team, if it had Tom Brady?
There was never a question in my mind, always. But when people have asked me that question, like, hey, Belichick or Brady, I always say both. And the right answer still is both. Because the Patriots would have made the playoffs this year if they had Tom Brady as the quarterback. And Tom Brady, as good, he's balling out. He's doing great. He would be happy. He would be happier with the operation if he were in New England, because he knew that offense. That's his offense. There's no, hey, well, why don't you do like 70% of your offense and 30% of ours? No. In New England, that was all his. I remember players telling me, Hopeton, hey, we don't run the offensive coordinator's offense. We run Tom Brady's offense. If the coordinator says, I want you to run it out and just be ready at 9 yards. And Tom Brady says, no, run it out and be ready at 8. We run it at 8. We're doing what Tom says, because Tom is essentially the coach on the field. So, I mean, it's always partnerships. I believe in partnerships. It's not just one. It's not just Belichick would win a Super Bowl without Brady, but he wouldn't win 6. And Brady would win without Belichick, but it wouldn't be 6.
Together. Yeah, but I tend to think that there's way too much credit given when, you know, football is the ultimate team game.
Sure it is.
It's the ultimate team game. Yet you look at, say, an Aaron Rodgers or Drew Brees, all-time great quarterbacks, top 5 or 6 all-time quarterbacks, just won Super Bowl each.
Yeah, and it's a lot of things. It could be the team. It could be that year. It can just be that year. You know, you got a great team. You just run into somebody who gets hot at the right time. Like the Patriots.
You mean like Eli Manning? hey, on the listen, Patriots twice?
I don't hate on it. I tell you this, man. I find inspiration from so many things, even things that are negative or so-called negative. Man, I was at that game where the Patriots lost their undefeated season to Eli Manning and the Giants. And the Giants came into that game 10-point underdogs. So I look at it and say, so an underdog could be a champion. <You know? laughs> Anyway, I always look at it and say, all right, what kind of lesson can I draw from this? Even when, you know, mentioned Belichick and Brady, and there are some people in Boston who will say, well, look, Belichick was nothing without Brady. And look what happened. I said, okay, that's not a negative. Here's a lesson. What I just heard you say is, as a coach or as a business person, you might be one piece away from greatness. It might be a director over one of your businesses. It might be a business plan. You could be one piece away from greatness. So don't tell me that's a negative, that, hey, Belichick was nothing without Brady. Great. He had enough of something to be an almost champion, and he got one more thing to put it all together. So that's all of us. We're one step away from greatness. See, I told you, man, I turn this stuff around all the time.
Well, the problem I think we have as fans, and it goes beyond that, just not being fans of sports, is the narratives are always have to be simplistic, right? You know, yeah. One or the other, good versus evil. To me, it's sort of like the relationship between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Oh, you know, oh, the myth is
they hated each other.
Well, the reality is W.E.B. Du Bois actually wrote a congratulatory note to Booker T. Washington when he made his Atlanta Compromise speech, that Booker T. Washington twice twice tried to hire W.E.B. Du Bois to come to Tuskegee, and that they had an incredibly complicated relationship that, I mean, I've read notes between the two, and I that sort of was my hobby. I used to work for the NAACP.
I love this.
For many years. So their relationship, like there's a book of correspondence that I found in a Black bookstore here in Texas in Dallas.
What's the name
and
of the
I
book?
Read,
what's the name of the
I'd
book?
Have to, I don't, you know what? I'm going to have to look it up because it's been years since I pulled it off
when
the
you,
shelf.
When you get it, email me that because I'd be so interested in.
Oh, man. Reading correspondence that. Between them, like when they were trying to get back together and they had a committee of 12 and all the stuff that was going on. But the message I got, like even the way they fell out, which was really strange, is that actually it was in Boston. The publisher of a Black newspaper in Boston hated Booker T. Washington. And W.E.B. Du Bois was good friends with them because they both went to Harvard. So Booker T. Washington was scheduled to speak at a meeting of the Negro Business League in Boston. Mm. And so this guy who was the publisher, Monroe Trotter.
Oh, yeah.
W. Monroe Trotter.
Yeah.
Planned to.
William
Monroe Trotter to give him hell at that meeting. And he did. And because W.E.B. Du Bois was in town and good friends with William Monroe Trotter, Booker T. Washington actually thought W.E.B. Du Bois was part of this conspiracy to make him look bad. So that's when they completely fell out, because at that point in time, Booker T. Washington was respected by the captains of industry, and they expected him to keep the Black community under control.
Yeah, that's right.
For him to be publicly outed in the paper.
Right.
Exactly. Just outed like that, and it hit the paper, meant that maybe Booker T. Washington didn't have the control that they thought he should. And because he was controlling, when there was a shift of the money for HBCUs coming from the American Missionary Association and the churches to the captains of industry, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, Booker T. Washington had a lot of control over that money.
It's so amazing when you think about it. And you said it perfectly. I love it. And if you find that book, please give me that email, that book title to me. I'd love to read it. But you said it perfectly when you talk about these storylines and the simplicity of them. Now, sometimes stories are simple, but there's a lot of nuance involved, especially when you're talking about people who are in the same condition, who are dealing with the same enemy, but may have different approaches to dealing with that enemy, how they're somehow separate. No, it's not separate. It's just a different approach. But they're all in the same. They're all in the same realm. Whether it's Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, whether it's Malcolm X, a Muslim, and Martin Luther King Jr., a Christian. And I know at times they went at it. You know, some of the great speeches. I got a book from this new book from Malcolm about Malcolm that came out by Lance Payne. There's so many incidents examples where. Well, Malcolm X would say, hey, you know, these so-called Negro leaders or, you know, these Uncle Toms. Yeah, he would say that, and that's inflammatory. But if you really study Martin Luther King's, what he's saying, the essence of what he's saying, there are many times where, you know, you would think that it was MLK or it was Malcolm and not MLK or whatever. They had a lot of similar themes.
Did you know there was a dual biography of the two? That Peniel Joseph, a professor at UT Austin, wrote a dual biography of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King.
He was here for a while. That's a smart brother. He was at Tufts University.
Yes, yes.
In Boston for a while. Yeah, that's a great brother right there. You guys are fortunate to have him in that area, no question. No.
I do a little book festival called Diverse Literary Voices of Texas, and I had him on a panel. So we were looking at the learning from the civil rights history of the past for the social justice leaders of today. So on this panel, I had Peniel Joseph talking about his biography, dual biography of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I had the president of the Austin NAACP, who had been president 20 years and started the battle fighting the Austin Police Department way back when, in the early 2000 aughts and the racism, and a young Black woman that was killed by the police. Mm. I had a retired professor of journalism from Louisiana Tech University that actually marched against the police with activist groups in Houston when he was a professor at TSU and the editor of a Black newspaper there. And then I had a young Black professor from, where is he at? University of Tennessee, who wrote a book about a Black civil rights leader from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s out of North Carolina. And so what I was trying to do with this panel, it's actually online, matter of fact. I just put it up. It's a two-hour panel.
You got some work to do after this, man. You got some work to do after this interview.
All you got to do is, do you have an iPhone?
Yeah, of course.
Well, Apple Podcasts, Hope to Hate Podcasts. I put up my interviews there. That I put that one up about a week or two ago. But getting that group in the room, because one of the reasons I want to bring them together is I saw the social justice movement crest in Austin. We had 10,000 folks at Houston-Tillerson University, our local HBCU. And there's all this focus on Black Lives Matter and the other movements in it today. I said, well, wait a minute. I mean, I'm all for them, but are they forgetting that Nelson Linder, president of NAACP, was protesting the Austin Police Department with one or two other people with a sign by himself? We didn't have 10,000 white people supporting us. He was out there by himself protesting the shooting of a mentally unstable young Black woman by the police. It's like they forget that where they are today, depending on all this work, all these other folks have done and continue to do. And that's one of the discussions I have with the younger generation of leaders, not forgetting how we got there today. I had a conversation with a local city council member, and I run a historically utilized business program for the University of Texas System. And he's just started, you know, he's like maybe 40, lawyer. And he just started railing on the program. So wait a minute. You're not being nuanced. I've worked in this program. Let me tell you how this program really works. Stop painting this picture of it's failing. I said that is not true. You have to look at agency by agency, because he's jumping on it without, hey, I'm on the board of the Texas NAACP and I've worked in it. So I'm an activist and I can tell you from the inside. So, you know, my only point is that, you know, as I tell my 15-year-old daughter all the time, if you're going to take a stand, do your damn research.
Hey, preach, brother. Yes, yes, that's right. And it's a great point to make. Not only do your research, but also remember, and this is liberating for all of us, we're not reinventing anything.
Nope.
It's not new. Now we have a new energy and a new spirit, and we have more information now than ever before, but there's significant work that has been done that we can just stand on that work, and now it's going to launch us to a new realm. But we're not inventing anything, because there are so many people who have come before us, and I'm not talking about come before us 100 years ago, 150 years ago. There's people who have done it like 25 years ago, 30 years ago,
who's still living
when it wasn't popular.
Yep.
But they were doing that work. So yeah, we can't be so arrogant to think that, hey, now that I'm in it, this whole thing is wide open, it's new. No, you're in it. You may be in it late.
Well, I'll let you go with this. There was a quote by Sir Isaac Newton, I'm not great at memorizing stuff, but he said, I may have seen farther than any man has seen before me, but it's only because I stand on the shoulders of giants. Hmm. So,
yes.
Hey, well, this has been a great conversation, man. I'm gonna let you get back to your family here on
I love it.
The holidays.
I just want to thank you for reaching out. I just knew it. I don't know why. I said, man, that's somebody I got to talk to. I didn't know why at the time, but now I do.
this has been quite a joy. Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. Subscribe to us under Hopeton Hay Podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many other sources of podcasts. If you like this interview, be sure to rate it. Rate it a 5. Give us 5 stars. You can follow KAZI Book Review on Twitter under at KAZI Books. You can also follow us under Facebook under KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay. And you can also follow us on Instagram under KAZI_book_review. Thank you once again for listening to the KAZI Book Review podcast.